Nicole Lally was a rookie journalist with a gut feeling. As if by fate, she had stumbled onto what she thought had the potential to be a big news story. Later on, it would become the most memorable story of her career.
In January of 2005, I was on my way into work for a night shift, and I stopped at McDonald's, and there was a woman there hanging up signs of missing people. Knowing I was going to the station and need to bring some story ideas, I kind of stopped. It was Adrian Reynolds' stepmother, and she was obviously had been upset and crying, and Adrian was missing, and I explained to her that I was a reporter, and I got her contact information. I went into work and said, hey, we don't typically jump on cases of missing teens because a lot of times it's a runaway or some family dispute. So we kind of wait for police to lead us if it's something more. And I just had this gut feeling, and I really pushed my news director, Arthur Stedman, at the time to let me kind of make some phone calls. Let me talk to this family and see what was going on. And I actually set up an interview for that night at Adrian Reynolds' home with her family.
Soon, Nicole, who at the time worked at CBS-affiliated channel WHBF in Rock Island, Illinois, and other reporters across the country were captivated by the Adrian Reynolds case. This is Jillian, and you are listening to Court Junkie, episode 135. Sixteen-year-old Adrian had been the new kid at school at the Black Hawk Outreach Center, an alternative high school in East Moline, Illinois, which was part of the Quad Cities on the Mississippi River. Adrian was badly behind academically, and she was in the Midwest under troubled circumstances. She had fought her biological mother in Texas and was now going to live with her stepmother and adopted father in East Moline and pursue her GED at the center. Despite her past, Adrian was still an outgoing, boy-crazy, boisterous teenager who was full of energy, according to her stepmother, Joanna Reynolds.
Yeah, and you know, Adrian really wasn't a bad kid. She really wasn't. She was high-spirited, you know, happy, you know, always, you know how teenagers are, and, you know, she was a happy-go-lucky kid. She was very, sometimes it was irritating because, you know, like we talk down here. Where Adrian, are we talking up here, you know?
What her stepmother remembered was Adrian's love of singing. Adrian was always belting out songs. She dreamed of winning a spot on American Idol, the show she regularly watched.
And oh my God, she loved music. She wanted to be, on American Idol. She loved to sing. She was very good at singing. She was very high-spirited and loved to sing.
Adrian didn't have no mean bone in her body. She wouldn't hurt nobody.
In her new life at her new school, it didn't take long for Adrian to discover a social circle. She met classmate Sarah Kolb, who instantly made her family feel uncomfortable.
But the first time we met Sarah, she came to our house goth, and our dog didn't even like her.
16-year-old Sarah was reportedly bisexual. She dressed in black and wore black makeup. She was popular at her alternative school, although she seemed to fit in with a crowd that ran on the fringes, the goth kids, the emo teenagers, the social outcasts, the juggalos who were fans of the hip-hop group, the Insane Clown Posse. But Adrian was clearly impressed by Sarah, who had her own car and a job working at a movie theater. Sarah seemed to have her own following at the school. One of Sarah's most loyal friends was Corey Gregory. Adrian was eager to get to know Corey, too. Like any teenager in a new school, Adrian was trying to find her place in the world, said Toria Wilson, a morning show executive producer at WQAD-TV, who's the host of the station's Missing and Murdered in the Midwest podcast.
She was trying to fit in. She was trying to fit in somewhere where, you know, she just felt like a missing puzzle piece coming to East Moline and not knowing anybody and just trying to be there with people. And I think that at 16, you know, that's already a struggle as it is. But to move somewhere and not know people and not know who you really are, you know, it's just out of place. And I think that's how she felt. But she felt somewhat at home with Corey and Sarah in some way, shape, or form. And I think that, you know, just being a misguided teen, that put her in trouble, you know? And it's not her fault, you know? She didn't know who she was, you know, messing with, you know?
But Adrian's newly discovered social circle had incredibly complicated dynamics. Crushes, teenage romance, and jealousy. At times, there were moments of innocence. Adrian wrote Corey love notes, but some of the public documents show how the teenagers acted beyond their years, as there are regular references to sex and occasionally to drugs.
From what Corey described in some of the interviews he's done, you know, he kind of locked eyes with Adrian Reynolds and they just were like instantly hooked. You know, they were hooked on one another. But here's Sarah. You know, Sarah was, you know, right alongside Corey. And Corey had a huge fascination with Sarah. I mean, he was deeply infatuated with her from what it sounded like. And, you know, she could do no wrong in his eyes. But at one point, you know, Sarah and Corey had dated and then they broke up, but they stayed friends. And then Corey had like a slight crush on Adrian. And then Adrian had a slight crush on Sarah at one point and was bi-curious and, you know, was trying to figure all that out, which Sarah was just like not having. And then, of course, when Adrian and Corey were like kind of flirting with one another, that's when Sarah especially just did not like that. Even though she wanted nothing to do with Corey in a romantic way anymore, she was not feeling that. And then the whole bisexuality thing, I think that that's what played a part in leading up to what actually happened.
One day, Adrian disappeared. She went to school in the morning, like normal, but didn't show up for her afternoon shift at the Checkers fast food restaurant. Her family called the police and put up the missing posters that caught the attention of Nicole Lally on her way to work. Almost immediately, Nicole began covering the story of the missing teenager. She described the first interview with Adrian's family.
It was a really emotional interview. They were really upset. They kind of knew something was going on. They knew she had been with Sarah Cole. They knew she was a newer friend at school. And, you know, Adrian and Sarah had gone to this high school that was kind of for kids that didn't fit in other places. So some troubled kids, some kids with learning difficulties, you know, they were kind of in this program and they met each other and they were becoming friendly. And I remember Adrian's stepmom and her grandfather, who had custody of her, saying that there was just something not right and that Sarah called parents or Sarah had lawyered up.
Within hours of Adrian's disappearance on January 21st, 2005, East Moline police officer Josh Allen called Sarah on the phone as their investigation got underway.
Hello?
Hi, I'm looking for Sarah.
Hold on.
Sarah told Officer Allen that she doesn't like Adrian and that, in fact, they had gotten into an argument at school and again in her car.
That's all I really know about her. I try not to talk to her because we don't get along.
How is it that she, you know, was in the car with you today? Were you supposed to give her a ride or something?
Yeah,
if you don't like her, how
I wasn't supposed to give her a ride. The guy that usually gives her a ride wasn't here today. It's really cold out, and we got into an argument at school in between classes, and she was crying to me and just kept going on and on about all the stories, which I already spoke to with her brother about it, and he already told me that she's a liar. But she had just been crying to me about it, and I was like, well, let's talk it over at lunch. I'll drive you home. Let's just talk about it. And she had been hanging out with my friend who likes me, and I like him, but she likes him. And we got an argument about that because she wouldn't leave him alone. When we were in my car, we got into an argument about it. And it just went on and on and on, and I was like, you know what? I don't even want to be your friend. I don't want anything to do with it. And basically, we just apologized. She said she was sorry. I said I was sorry for being frank in the way that I did because I know I overreacted. And I said, oh, I'm going to take you home now. And she's like, you know, my dad can't see that I'm in the car with the boy. I said, I'll drop you off at McDonald's then. That was it.
Officer Allen told her Adrian was supposed to go into work that night after leaving Sarah, but that she hadn't shown up.
So at 1 o'clock, you and Corey dropped...
It was probably more like 12:45. Lunch is in between 12:30 and 1 o'clock.
Okay, 12:45. You and Corey dropped Adrian off...
At the front door. Is it like...
You there?
Yeah, I'm sorry, okay. I have a call coming in.
At the front door of McDonald's, then where did you guys go from there?
We went back to my house because I was supposed to take, because it's my grandma's 62nd birthday today.
Uh-huh.
And we went to Alito, and I stopped by for like 5 minutes to change, and then we went to Alito, and when I got back towards Milan, I had 15 unplayed voice messages, and they're all from her brother Josh, and her mom's freaking out. I mean, obviously, she doesn't know where her kid is, and they just want to know where they are, and they told me that they're getting a hold of all of her friends, and nobody knows where she is.
Sarah said Adrian's mom calling her so many times was completely understandable. She said she's run away before, too.
I've ran away once before, and my mom called every single one of my friends.
Oh, yeah.
They found me, though. They found me in, like, a couple days.
Well, that's good.
Officer Allen was about to end the call when Sarah had a question.
I think I got everything I can from you.
I do have a question, though.
What's up?
Her brother, well, he wasn't really hostile or rude. He's just upset, you know.
Yeah.
He had told me that, you know, the cops are looking for you, and if they find you with her, you're all going to be arrested.
Yeah.
Which, I'd understand that. But she's not with me. And even if she did ran away or whatever, I would, because I don't like her.
Yeah.
But. Is there, like, a warrant out for me or what? Because I really don't know what's going on.
No,
That's kind of what it sounded like.
I'm sure you understand. In his, frustration and whatnot, he's, you know, wants to get her back or whatever. And,
yeah, he's upset.
And you, and obviously, you know, you being the last one to have contact with her, we need to talk with you.
Yeah.
But, no, in the event that, you know, we list her as a runaway or whatnot.
Yeah.
And she's at your house, and you know that she's with you, and you don't call the police.
Oh yeah, that's all.
Then it turns into something like that.
Oh yeah,
but we're not to that point at all. That's all that is.
All right, that's all I really wanted to know.
Did Sarah know more than what she was saying? On January 24th, 3 days after Adrian still hadn't returned home, Sarah Kolb, along with her mother and an attorney, spoke with a police investigator who reiterated that they wanted to hear her side of the story. In the interview, Sarah again explained that she had last seen Adrian on that Friday, the day Adrian was last seen by anyone. They had made a kind of spur-of-the-moment trip to Taco Bell, she said. We're not friends, but we're not enemies, Sarah told the investigator. She apologized for what she said, and I apologized for overreacting. In another phone conversation with police earlier, Sarah had been less diplomatic. She had told police that Adrian was promiscuous and was a pathological liar. Sarah admitted that she had even told her that she hated her. You're a slut, you spread like Jiffy, she recalled saying to her. But Sarah said she took Adrian with her to Taco Bell because the classmate who usually gave Adrian a ride home wasn't there. Over her repeated conversations with police, Sarah admitted to hitting Adrian in the Taco Bell parking lot and said that Adrian had hit her back. According to Sarah, Adrian then began crying. "I was like, you know what? You're not even worth it," Sarah said she told Adrian. "I'm not going to get in trouble over some stupid minor who is a skank." And I was like, just keep it simple. Stay away from me. Stay away from my boyfriend and stay away from Corey. And then Sarah said she dropped Adrian off at the parking lot of the nearby McDonald's near Adrian's home. The detectives followed up and asked Sarah questions. Who was the boy who usually gave Adrian a ride home? What about the man that Adrian babysits for? Or the guys that Adrian may have hooked up with? Who was the person she used to be in love with who may have been back in Texas? Any tip, any lead to help find Adrian? Sarah reiterated she didn't know what happened to her. She had no idea if she was hurt. She didn't know where Adrian may have gone. "We're not focusing on you as a suspect or anything like that. We're not trying to alert you or alarm you," the investigator said as Sarah, her mother, and her attorney listened on. "We just basically have to follow up. It's our job to try and figure out where this young lady's at." I know, Sarah replied. They were done with their questions. The interview was over. Sarah went on her way. She wanted to get her paycheck before the bank closed. Some missing persons cases drag on for weeks and months. The uncertainty lingers, growing more and more as families worry and wonder. But not this case. It was moving fast. A major revelation broke within days of Adrian vanishing.
It was a couple days later that the Corey Gregory had gone to police and kind of, you know, spilled his guts and got everything rolling.
East Moline Police Detective Brian Foltz and Illinois State Police Agent Mike Shekel interviewed Corey Gregory on January 25, 2005. 17-year-old Corey's name is officially redacted in the transcripts because he was a minor, but it's clear it's Corey based on the nature of his account, his eventual charges, and what emerged from court testimony later on. Corey set the scene for the investigators. Around lunchtime on January 21st, four teenagers rode in Sarah's red Geo Prism to get Taco Bell. There was Corey, Sarah, Adrian, and a fourth, later to be revealed in court as classmate Sean McKittrick, who was Sarah's boyfriend. The story sounded almost unbelievable as Corey described what had unfolded outside the fast food restaurant at a busy lunch hour in broad daylight. The two girls began arguing in the car while the boys listened from the back seat as they parked near the drive-thru. At least 10 people walked by, Corey recalled. Sarah accused Adrian of being promiscuous with boys. In the midst of the arguing, Sean decided he couldn't take it anymore. "This isn't right," he said as he climbed out of the car and walked away. He didn't come back. According to Corey, the girls' argument soon got physical. "Sarah and Adrian were struggling to choke each other," he said. "And then Sarah was moving all around and eventually got into the back seat. Well, halfway into the back seat, in between the seats. I was in the back seat looking out the window. They were just choking each other. And then, before I knew it, they quit choking each other. And Adrian was blue. Her lips were blue and her face was blue. She was dead. She wasn't breathing and her entire face turned blue." Corey said the fight had gone too far. Sarah had accidentally killed Adrian. Later during the interview, the detectives asked follow-up questions, prompting Corey to give more details. Corey said that during the physical fight, Adrian had punched Sarah, breaking her nose. Sarah and I started freaking out, he said. Sarah was scared and I was scared. They put Adrian's body in the back seat with Corey's black and tan Nike coat draped over her head. They then began driving and talking, a plan formulating for how they wanted to get rid of Adrian's body. Sarah assumed the rest of the world would believe that Adrian had just run away. Sarah stopped by her house and grabbed a gas can from her garage. With Adrian's body in the trunk, Sarah and Corey headed to Sarah's grandmother's farm outside Aledo, Illinois, a small rural town about 35 minutes from Rock Island. It was a place they sometimes went to play paintball, and Sarah had just recently gone to the farm to celebrate her grandmother's birthday. Once at the farm, Sarah used a blue plastic tarp she found to drag Adrian's body to a spot into the woods. Sarah poured the gas onto Adrian and then lit it with a lighter, Corey said. And then Sarah and I stood there, but we couldn't look. We couldn't look at it. He outlined how they tried to pass the time as the fire burned on. They went back to the car and listened to music. They drove to Sarah's grandma's antique shop and perused the items. They drove to get more gas at a gas station in town. By now, it was dusk. The sky was turning dark. There was still snow on the ground. Sarah's grandpa appeared. He had been feeding the cows on the farm. He chased the two teenagers out, asking why they had showed up unannounced without saying hello. The teens returned back to the fire as Adrian's body continued to burn. Sarah added more gasoline to light it up again. I wasn't watching because I couldn't watch. It was too hard to watch because it was a person, Corey said, as the detectives pressed him for more details. Corey went on. Sarah was pretty much just on the verge of crying. And then after Sarah was done and lit her up, Sarah laid her head on my shoulder, and she was crying. They covered Adrian's burnt remains with sticks, and finally, they returned back home to Moline. The next day, Sarah went to her job at the movie theater. On Sunday, 2 days after the murder, Corey said he returned to the farm again. The detective asked him why he was still involved. Because I love Sarah and I was scared because I was in the car with Sarah and I thought since I was there with her in the car when it happened that I was automatically in trouble for it, he said. It was clear that Corey was fiercely loyal to Sarah. They hung out every day and were best friends, even after they had broken up 9 months earlier, after a short 2.5 week relationship, a teenage romance that was a blip in time. But now, Corey had gotten an attorney and was speaking to law enforcement without Sarah's knowledge. He was warned not to speak with Sarah anymore as investigators continued to investigate Adrian's death. Corey explained how he and Sarah went back to the farm Sunday, back to the path in the woods and to the spot where the fire had burned for hours. According to Corey, Sarah then used a metal handsaw and cut off Adrian's head and arms and placed the dismembered remains in a black trash bag that Corey had brought from his kitchen. And then they drove back to a Rock Island County park where Sarah wanted to dig a hole and bury the plastic bag. Corey offered to take police back to that spot. Corey's version of events squarely placed the blame on Sarah killing Adrian and mutilating her corpse. There was no mention of anyone else involved, as he said the two best friends had returned alone to the farm together on that Sunday and then dumped the bag at the park. But just a few weeks later, someone would tell a different story. Multiple authoritative adults gathered in the room as the interview with the juvenile began on the morning of March 25, 2005, at the Peoria Juvenile Detention Center. There was Rock Island State's Attorney Jeff Torones, Illinois State Police Sergeant Mike Sheckel, and Defense Attorney Haney Khoury. Again, the juvenile's name was officially redacted in the 82 pages of the Illinois State Police Investigative's report's transcripts. But the horrific story the young man was about to give doesn't make it difficult to identify him. It's Nathan Gaudette, a a teenager who was later charged as a juvenile with concealment of a homicide. Haney Khoury was his legal counsel. At first, Nathan had no idea about Adrian's fate, although he was aware that the two girls had gotten into a fight earlier that day. Nathan then hung out with Sarah and others on Friday night at a gathering where cocaine and alcohol were both present. It wasn't until Saturday afternoon, as Sarah and Nathan and who appears to be Khoury, again the name is redacted, were together again as Nathan was on a mission going across town to find a CD when he learned about Adrian's death. He was the only person Sarah and Khoury could trust, he told authorities. Nathan hadn't known Adrian well, but he had been friends with Sarah for 2 years, since they met one day at the mall. There was a sense of darkness to Nathan. Nathan could often be seen wearing a trench coat. He wore contact lenses, freaky ones, said his grandmother, that made his eyeballs look all white with a black X on them, or black with blue diamonds. He wore them daily. Knowing that Nathan was someone she could trust, Sarah recounted the Taco Bell parking lot attack to him. From the front seat, Sarah told him she had reached back and grabbed Adrian. Adrian fought back. She punched Sarah in the nose. Nathan said it was broken. The blow was enough to draw blood. At one point, he said Sarah took out a wooden stick from her back seat. She called it her N-word beater, Nathan said because she was racist, and began hitting Adrian in the head. Sarah then asked Khoury to hold down Adrian's arms. And I guess Sarah choked her to death then, Nathan said. He said Khoury had tied a belt around Adrian's neck to make sure she wouldn't come back to life. Nathan learned about how they had gone to the farm to destroy the remains and how the body burned under a tarp covered in gasoline for 6 hours. But even then, the fire wasn't enough to destroy Adrian's remains, he said. They needed his help. They had mentioned that they wanted me to cut up the body and, Nathan said, recounting their exact words to help him get rid of it. They wanted him to spread out her teeth and her DNA so Adrian's remains couldn't be identified. So what was your response? Sergeant Shekel asked. I was kind of weirded out and didn't really believe him at the time, Nathan said. The adults in the room sounded skeptical. Sergeant Shekel spoke first. Because I gotta admit, you know, I'm riding around with a couple of friends of mine and they're like, oh, by the way, we killed somebody and we want you to cut up the body. I mean, that would freak me out, he said. Well, I got freaked out and then started asking him like questions about how they did it, Nathan replied. What questions did you ask them? Sergeant Shekel wanted to know. He assumed Nathan would have had 1,000 questions, but the teenager said he was mostly thinking to himself and wondering if they were really telling the truth. I said, who was it? And then, when'd you do it? How'd you do it? Nathan said. Nathan was fully caught up in the scheme. He said he felt like he had no choice. They told me, since they had already told me the story, that I was already involved and that no matter what, I'd get into trouble, he said. I was already involved, so I might as well help them to not get caught. Sunday, they called me in the morning and said, get your stuff, we're ready. Sarah and Khoury pulled up and picked him up. Got in the car. They asked me, did you bring a saw? Nathan said. I said, no. Ran back inside my house, got the saw. Came back out. Nathan's mom thought he was going to the movies as they drove to Mercer County and back to the farm where Adrian's body was hidden under the sticks. For the first time, Nathan knew that they had been speaking the truth. The confirmation lay in front of him. This is Adrian, Khoury said, according to Nathan's interview, as he saw her badly burned body. Nathan said he didn't look at Adrian's face. Then I cut up the body, he said. Nathan matter-of-factly told the grisly details. He had knelt down on his knees and used the saw that he had brought from his grandfather's basement. He dismembered her head and her torso in silence. Nobody spoke. Adrian's burnt necklace fell off her neck. He said Sarah picked it up from the ground and put it in the car's trunk. Corey then put the head and arms in a black bag, Nathan said. As the state's attorney, Nathan's attorney, and Illinois State Police investigators listened. The teens then threw the rest of Adrian's remains in a ravine. They got back into the car, detouring to McDonald's first for food, and then on to find a place to dump the grisly contents inside the plastic bag. First, Big Island, a place where people bike and fish, but it was too crowded. The next option was Black Hawk State Park, a 208-acre park, home to bald eagles and other animals. At the park, they followed a trail, Corey holding the shovel, Nathan holding the bag of body parts, as they went down some stairs. They stumbled across a manhole cover, which the two boys managed to lift up. That's where they threw the plastic bag of body parts. Police would find Adrian's dismembered remains on January 26, 2005, 5 days after she was reported missing. Corey followed through on his promise and led them to the hiding place. Without his help, Nicole Lally wondered if Adrian's body would ever have been recovered by authorities, or if she would have forever remained a missing person. After the manhole cover was on again, Nathan said he hid the shovel in his trench coat and they returned to the car. Nathan had his orders: clean up the blood from his grandfather's saw and return it back to its place. But when Nathan's grandmother stumbled upon the saw, she put two and two together.
And she knew that he had associated with Sarah and Corey. And I think the police were, you know, kind of throwing up, casting a wide net to speak to people. And she went in her basement and she said she saw the bloody saw. And, you know, in her gut, she knew she had to make that call and turn him in. And as a grandmother and as a caretaker, and that's an incredibly difficult position she was in.
During Nathan's interview, authorities sounded puzzled as they tried to recreate how Adrian and Sarah, whose friendship was broken, ended up together at Taco Bell on January 21st. Maybe you can help me out with it. If we have two people who don't like each other, we have Sarah who doesn't like Adrian, and Adrian who doesn't like Sarah, what are they doing in a car together? Sergeant Sheckle asked Nathan. Nathan responded that Adrian was eager for a chance to spend time with Corey, and Sarah acted like she was cool with it again. But Sarah's attitude transformation was a trap. Adrian climbed into the backseat of the car, unsuspecting that Sarah was luring her in to kill her, according to Nathan. How do you know that? Sergeant Sheckle asked. Because Sarah and Corey told me that, Nathan replied. Let me ask you, Sergeant Sheckle stopped Nathan as the interview continued. When all this stuff is going on, and you guys are actually doing the stuff, did any one person seem to be in charge? Sarah. Why do you say that? The sergeant asked. She just seemed like she was in charge and knew what she was doing, Nathan said. Like she had a plan. But the authorities questioned Nathan's reliability. They were clearly unsure if he would be a reliable witness in court. That March 25th interview wasn't Nathan's first time speaking with Illinois State Police. Nathan had earlier requested a polygraph as he cooperated with authorities and answered questions about his friends. For the polygraph, he was asked, "Did Sarah Kolb tell you that she choked Adrian Reynolds?" Nathan said yes. The polygraph results? He wasn't telling the truth. "What's your explanation to that?" Sergeant Sheckle asked Nathan during the March 25th interview. I don't think the questions were specific enough," Nathan said. "The examiner had told me not to think about my breathing, because on the last test I screwed up the polygraph by breathing, so he told me not to think about it." Nathan's mind wandered and he wasn't focused on the questions, he added. You need to understand something, State's Attorney Jeff Terones said. When I put someone on the witness stand, I have to know that they are not testifying falsely, okay? Yes, Nathan said. So when I saw that question and that answer and the fact that you failed, that causes me concern. Understand that? He asked. Why should I believe you? Why should I put that testimony on the witness stand? Because I am telling the truth, Nathan replied. Even in light of what the polygraph says, that's what you're telling me? Terones asked. Yes, Nathan insisted. The state's attorney warned he could prosecute Nathan for lying on the witness stand under oath, so he would be in more trouble than what he was already facing. Nathan was persistent. He was being honest. The interview was over. It had lasted more than 2 hours. Authorities were convinced after interviewing multiple witnesses that they now knew who all was involved and what each teenager's role had been. 16-year-old Nathan was charged as a juvenile with concealing a homicide. Because Nathan agreed to cooperate with the state, he wouldn't be charged with a felony as an adult. But Corey and Sarah were. They were both charged as adults with 2 counts of first-degree murder and concealment of a homicide.
After this all broke and when Sarah was arrested, I was there for that first perp walk. And if you've watched any of the old stories, you've seen the video. And here's a girl wearing an outfit, like she looks like she stepped out of the Gap, and this bob haircut. And you're just like, how is she accused of murdering someone? It just didn't fit the image that society would typically have.
The news broke that the teenagers had killed and dismembered their classmate. The grisly crime drew intense media coverage, leading the local newscasts for weeks and appearing in national headlines too. At the time, Toria Wilson, the morning show executive producer at WQAD-TV, was growing up in the Quad Cities, only a few years younger than Adrian and Sarah had been. The case had struck fear in parents across the community. Do you really know your children's friends?
I think mostly I remember just kind of like a panic with my parents. I didn't read the news at that point, but I definitely remember my parents being worried about who I was hanging out with and, you know, where I was going and you know, what was I doing? Because it was just like that, who is your friend? You know, it was a little bit more of a heightened awareness of you might not know who these people really are.
In 2006, Corey, now 18, pleaded guilty to 1 count of first-degree murder under a plea agreement with the state, so he didn't stand trial. The Quad City Times reported Rock Island County State's Attorney Jeff Terones said during the hearing that the state would have shown evidence proving that Corey held Adrian's arms down while Sarah choked her, and that Corey then placed a belt around Adrian's neck in the car. On Halloween 2005, 17-year-old Sarah Kolb's 2-week trial began. According to the Quad City Times, 5 out of the 21 potential jurors were dismissed because they believed Sarah was guilty based on what they read or saw in the news. The prosecution presented their case, saying Sarah, along with Corey, strangled and killed Adrian. Jurors heard from multiple witnesses, including Sarah herself. Sarah acknowledged a fight between the two girls at Taco Bell, but she insisted she only pulled Adrian's hair and yelled at her. Toria Wilson, who researched the case for her TV station's podcast, said that on the stand, Sarah made it clear who she thought was responsible for Adrian's death, Corey. Sarah testified that Corey beat Adrian with a stick and strangled her using a belt as a noose. Sarah said she had been scared for her life, so she followed along with Corey as they disposed of the body together. Corey then ordered Nathan to dismember the remains.
It sounded like she tried to point the blame to Corey. Okay, she tried to say that this was all Corey's doing. He was the one that strangled her. He was the one that did this. And Sarah was the helpless victim in this whole case. She was the one that was drugged to Alito. She was the one that, you know, she was actually, you know, a bystander that couldn't go away from this.
Nicole Lally said that in the courtroom, Sarah came off as cold.
She was emotionless. She almost answered the questions with a chip on her shoulder. She just kind of kept her head down. She just looked like a teen with an attitude. And I don't know if the gravity of the situation had sunk in or she just didn't care. But here she is on trial for murder. And she just had this chip on her shoulder. Like, yeah, so, no. Like, her answers were very flippant.
Corey didn't take the stand at Sarah's trial, although he gave his side in an exclusive media interview.
Corey Gregory did his, like, I think it was like only his second interview on TV, and that was with our News 8's Chris Miner. And he pretty much said, no, this was all Sarah. This was Sarah's doing. You know, she was the one that coerced me. I loved her so much. I'd do anything for her.
The nature of Adrian's death had been graphic, and so was the evidence shown to jurors, who saw disturbing images as Adrian's and Sarah's families sat in the courtroom.
They videotaped when Corey led them to the body, and when they were pulling that out, they had video and photos of the body parts and pretty graphic descriptions of the burning. I do, like, it still sticks in my head 15 years later that, you know, the left leg was never recovered. And that's just devastating. And to be Adrian's family sitting there listening to that, it was a lot.
For the prosecution, some of the biggest evidence against Sarah came from their star witness, Nathan, who had testified for 3 hours during the trial.
He was scared. I think that, you know, his persona and the image with the trench coat and all of that was a front. It was much bigger than who he actually was. But because of his age and because they were able to make a deal, he took the stand against her. And I think the plea kind of played into it. He was getting off pretty easy considering the sentence that he got compared to Sarah and Corey. He was definitely a troubled teen, though, and you could tell that. And I remember sitting in the courtroom and we'd be in recess or whatever and me talking with other reporters. And how do you get to that point at 15 years old to be the guy that someone calls when you have to cut up a body? At 15, how do you become that person? So you certainly get the troubled feeling, you know, from Nate.
The defense tried to cast doubt by arguing that Nathan said what police wanted to hear in order to get the plea deal and avoid charges as an adult. Nathan's grandmother also testified that she had a nagging feeling to search the basement after she heard about Adrian's disappearance, according to the Quad City Times newspaper, which also covered the trial. She found the handsaw in Nathan's backpack and contacted authorities. Also taking the stand, Sarah and Adrian's classmates described the hatred that Sarah had for Adrian, the new girl. Witnesses also painted a picture of Corey as obsessed with Sarah and following her around. Without a doubt, they said, Sarah was the ringleader. Rock Island County Circuit Judge James Taros read out loud Sarah's school journal to the jury. "I'll expletive kill her," Sarah had written in her entry on the day that Adrian went missing, although Sarah never explicitly said who she was referring to kill, according to the Quad City Times. A classmate hid the journal at first, but then turned it over to police after Adrian went missing. Sean McKittrick, Sarah's boyfriend, the fourth teenager in the car who had left when he sensed trouble arising, testified he saw Adrian sitting in the front seat. He said he didn't want to be around that type of situation when Sarah grabbed Adrian by the hair. "I asked Sarah to stop. What she was doing wasn't right," Sean testified, according to the newspaper. "She told me if I didn't like it, I could get out of the car." Sarah's grandparents, Mary and Brian Engel, also took the stand. Sarah's grandfather described how he spotted Sarah at the farm, but that she had showed up unannounced and then left quickly too. I asked what she was doing on the back of the farm, he testified. He said she was showing it to Corey. Sarah's grandmother called her granddaughter's demeanor quiet and fidgety. The jury deliberated for 15 hours.
And so I just remember sitting there waiting. We were playing cards. We were talking. I mean, this is 15 years ago, even before scrolls were our phones and Facebook. So you were just kind of sitting there passing the time, reading books. And I remember when they came down and they told us, they brought us back into the courtroom and they said it was a mistrial. I remember us racing to the elevators to get downstairs to those five trucks. And it was right around noon time and just being out of breath and just trying to like get everything off your chest. Like, this was a mistrial. This is what happened. And again, I think it was just like another layer of shock in this case. Like, how, when you have such a clear cut case and for weeks we've been telling you at this trial that, you know, it looked like the odds were stacked against Sarah, that to come back with a mistrial, it was a huge blow.
It was a hung jury, deadlocked 11-1 in favor of conviction. The mistrial was the result of a lone holdout juror who didn't necessarily think Sarah was innocent, but said the state failed to prove its case against her, according to the Quad City Times. Nicole remembered the intense emotions in the courtroom from the unexpected outcome after what had seemed like damning evidence against Sarah.
Just tears all around, tears from Adrian's family, tears from Sarah's family, because it was almost like this relief. But I think, you know, everybody knew this was not going to be the end of the case.
Sarah's retrial began in February 2006, moving from Rock Island, Illinois to Dixon, Illinois.
It was a very similar trial, with the exception that when it was the defense turn, they rested. She did not take the stand, and that was it. So it went faster, but otherwise, most of the evidence, there were no changes. The prosecution had a strong case, and they knew they had a strong case, and they stuck with that.
The biggest difference, however, was the outcome. To the relief of Adrian's stepmother, this time Sarah was found guilty.
When they said the verdict was in, all we did was cry, because we knew it. We knew in our hearts. We both cried before we went into the courtroom, because I think we both knew in our hearts it was over, and we knew it was guilty, because the evidence was there. It was a sigh of relief, and you know, there is no victory, but it was just a sigh of relief not knowing that they weren't going to get out.
Sarah was eventually sentenced to 53 years in prison. Corey Gregory was ordered to serve 45 years. As part of his plea deal, Nathan Gaudette was sentenced to 5 years in a juvenile detention center, although he would only serve 4 of those years. How did these kids ever get this way? Read a headline from a Quad City Times columnist. It seemed to summarize the community's reaction to the three defendants. Adrian's family wanted to do something to remember her, the energetic songbird they had lost. They started a scholarship fund to cover the expenses for alternative students to take the GED at the Black Hawk Outreach Center, where Adrian had attended.
Because Adrian was going to school to get her GED, so we just, you know, thought that would be good to, you know, keep her memory alive. We've been doing it ever since she died, and it helps about 12 kids a year. We get letters from the kids, you know, thanking us, and one kid actually said it was giving him a second chance in life.
In the years that followed, some of the prominent people who appeared at the trials would get caught up in scandals or tragedies of their own. Nathan's life was cut short after his release from juvenile custody. At age 23, he died in a car crash in Indiana in 2012. The Quad City Times had contacted Adrian's parents to get their reactions to the death of the person who had dismembered their daughter's body. "I'm just numb," Joanne Reynolds said at the time. "I don't know how I'm supposed to feel. I don't feel joy." The Rock Island state's attorney who prosecuted Sarah Kolb eventually lost his job in public disgrace. The Quad City Times reported that Jeff Chironas admitted to delivering alcohol to a teenager who had been a victim in a sex abuse case he had prosecuted. The state's attorney would ultimately lose his law license for at least 5 years and was disbarred by the Illinois Supreme Court. After years behind bars, Corey Gregory and Sarah Kolb, who are in their early 30s today, appealed their sentences.
Last year, in May of 2019, Corey filed an appeal with the Illinois Supreme Court. Essentially, he was saying that he was 17 at the time. You know, it was his first offense. You know, the standard sayings of this. And in Illinois, they had recently passed a law at that point that said that, you know, if you were a minor and you were charged as an adult, you know, your case needs to be essentially relooked at to see if you can essentially get a reduced time. You know, you shouldn't be a minor charged with, you know, life is what they're saying. The Illinois Supreme Court ruled that unconstitutional. So he filed this appeal. And he got a new sentencing hearing ordered. And as of now, the state is still trying to fight it. They're still trying to fight the appeal. And right now, it's still up in the air.
Corey's supporters created a controversial GoFundMe page to raise money for Corey to publish books he's been writing.
It was around the time that he got that new sentencing hearing that he posted that he wants to be an author. He had been writing books for the last, you know, like 15 years or whatever in prison. And with that, he wants to get published. And so he set up either he or somebody he knows set up a GoFundMe for him. And they only needed like $3,000 or some small amount for him to get his book published. And I remember Joanne Reynolds came out and was like, do not give him money. Do not give him money at all. And I think they only got like $30.
Meanwhile, Sarah has also tried, unsuccessfully so far, to get out of prison.
In February, they did an amended petition for post-conviction relief because she filed essentially the same thing with the Illinois Supreme Court. And that was dismissed in February, but in March they filed a motion to reconsider. So they're really trying to get her either a reduced sentence or get her out.
It's been 15 years since Adrian's death put the quiet, close-knit Illinois city in the national spotlight. Nicole marveled that the case, which had been the most high-profile one in her journalism career, is still regularly revisited.
Just the fact, again, that it's still a case that's attracting attention is incredible. And to have been a part of it, I don't want to say that I'm thankful that I was a part of it because it's a horrible thing, but I did learn a lot as a reporter. It's still something that, you know, is probably the biggest case of my career this many years later.
And that's all for today's episode. As always, I'd love to hear what you think about this case. Why do you think the three teenagers did something so unimaginably horrible? Do you agree with their sentences? Let me know by joining the conversation on Instagram at CourtJunkie, by tweeting me at CourtJunkiePod, or by emailing me at podcast@CourtJunkie.com. This episode was researched and written by Gabrielle Roussan. And a special thank you to everyone Gabrielle interviewed for this episode, including Nicole Lally, Toria Wilson, and Joanna Reynolds. For even more info on this case, be sure to check out Toria's podcast, Missing and Murdered in the Midwest. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.